The other thing, the only other thing we have to discuss is the an administrative factor involved with doing an interview. And basically what that is, by conducting an interview, having it recorded and then transcribed, you and I, both of us, have copyright control over the interview.
Okay.
And, of course, the whole purpose behind doing this oral history interview is so that we have a record that can be used by students and scholars and people who are interested in learning about the war. And one of the things that we both have to do, if we're going to make that available to people, is we have to sign an interview release form, which
okay.
basically assigns the copyright control of the interview over to Vietnam Archive, Texas Tech University.
Okay.
And there's a form that I will send you, an interview agreement form, and that will, of course, basically have that kind of language in it that we, you know, you and I both have to sign it and everything else.
Okay.
So do you have a problem with that?
No.
Okay.
Not at all.
All right. Well, great. Then why don't we go ahead and get started?
Okay.
All right. My name is Steve Maxner, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. James Parks. I am in Lubbock, Texas. He is in Mexia, Texas.
Mejia.
I'm sorry, Mejia.
That's right.
Okay. It is the 2nd of August, year 2000, approximately 9:15. And Mr. Parks, if you would please begin by giving us a brief biographical sketch of yourself.
Well, I was born in 42 in southwest Oklahoma. My father worked for the railroad, so we stayed in Oklahoma for several years, and then he was transferred to North Texas, Berkwinet, Texas, where I spent from the fourth grade on to graduation. So most of my time was spent in North Texas and stayed there until I was drafted and even moved back for the two or three years before I got married.
Okay, so what year did you graduate from high school, and what did you think when you received your draft notice?
Graduated in 60
okay.
and wasn't drafted until 64.
Mm-hmm.
And I quite honestly, I didn't think that I was going to be drafted because I'd just been turned down for a fairly, what I thought at that time, a fairly good job with Bell Telephone Company because of an abnormality in my back. So I thought it was a done deal. I'd just go down to Dallas and show them the x-rays and everything would be okay, but they had no problem with it. So I don't remember any particularly strong feelings. At that time, it was not like it is in year 2000. At that time, the draft was a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
So if you went in for a job interview, the very first question they ask you was, have you got your service over with? Which now would be illegal, but
mm-hmm.
they'd ask you.
Yeah.
And so the job market was not really good for somebody with no education. So
mm-hmm.
I didn't want to go into the Army, but at the same time, it wasn't like I left a lucrative position to go serve for 2 years.
And when you were drafted, did you have any... What month during 64 was it that you received your draft notice, do you recall?
No.
Okay.
March 3rd, 64.
Oh, okay. And you entered basic training at what point?
Shortly thereafter, good grief, I can't remember.
So sometime in the spring or early
yeah.
summer of
yeah, it was spring.
It was before the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Oh, it was, we're talking 64. Yes, before
okay.
that.
Okay. Now, when you received your draft notice, did you have any idea of what your military occupational specialty would become?
No.
Okay.
No, I made an error, one of many in my life. They asked for any specialty things. When you got drafted, the military asked over and over and over again, what do you do?
Okay.
Do you type? And I typed a little bit. I had it in high school, and I played a band instrument. I played a trumpet in high school. And I don't know why to this day, but I did not acknowledge either one of those things. So I was just going in blind, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Later, I did try out for a band, and that's how I ended up being in the band in Vietnam.
Okay. So you went to basic training at Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Fort Polk, yes.
What was that like?
I was blessed. I had a friend of mine that went through about the same time, and he was with a regular Army unit and had it much worse than I did. I happened to get into a battalion with National Guard and Army Reserves, NGs and ARs, and it was bad. I think the lower level of platoon leaders were more the stereotypical ugly sergeant that screams in your face more than the sergeants were. But it's still, as far as the regiment, the time we got up and what we did during the day and the time we finally got to go to bed, I don't think it was as bad as some of the regular Army units. It was not fun. You feel helpless, and that's what it's all there for. It's a re-socialization process, mm-hmm. and the Army does it real well because there were some pretty confident, what I seem to think were pretty strong people who were blithering blobs of jello by the time they got through with us after a few days.
Okay. What was the most challenging part of basic training for you?
The physical part. Okay. I am not athletic. I'm not overweight. In fact, I was skinny. Good. Not athletic at all, and the running and all that stuff. It was a constant worry to whether I would qualify mm-hmm. for this or that. And it could be pretty tough on you if you didn't. Mm-hmm. And I did. Okay. But that was, as far as the discipline, I had no problem with mm-hmm. it. Marching, I'd already marched, picked up on everything I could shoot. But that physical part worried me the whole time.
And what weapons training did you receive?
Just on the what did we have back then? M14?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think we were past the M1, thank God. Had one of those in ROTC for a while. It was horrible. M14.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you think of that weapon?
I loved it. I mean, if you can love a weapon, never failed on me.
Mm-hmm.
Easy to clean, easy to take apart, put back together. I never got my hands on a 16. They came to Nam after. Well, they were there, but the combat troops got them first. And 14, I thought was neat.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you went, well, what, any problems during basic training for you or for other people that were serving with you? Anybody have any problems adjusting or have discipline problems or anything like that?
Yeah, there was a guy, he was not in my squad, but he evidently was having some terrific psychological problems. He'd wet the bed, and it was tough on him because of the flack he took from the NCOs, and the platoon leaders, and everybody else for that matter. But really, we were a pretty normal bunch of people, and just kind of made it through the 2 months.
Okay. And then you went on to Fort Riley, Kansas.
Yes.
For your next training. What school was that?
It was communications, it was called. It's nothing nothing elaborate. What it was stringing wire for telephones for the artillery.
Okay.
I was attached to an artillery unit.
Mm-hmm.
And it being in a small unit always helps. I found that had to be more true after I got into the band. But being in a small unit, you tend to escape some of the things that some of the bad things that happen that come down in the Army and chores you're assigned. So really, it was not that bad. We had it was total freedom. You know, I remember an officer telling us, "Now you're in advanced training. This is just an extension of basic." And I had a hard time keeping from laughing. It was nothing like Fort Polk.
Mm. How long was that training?
It was another 2 months formally. Yeah, we climbed poles, strung wire, studied telephones, even studied things that were required by the Army that we never never even saw some of the equipment.
By telephone, you're talking about field telephones.
Field telephones.
Yeah.
The kind you crank. And, yep.
Okay. Now, do you recall when you left that training at Fort Riley?
We had our completion of our training, and I think we moved from one barracks to another. We were assigned to the very same battalion. And I cannot remember what it was other than it was the 1st Infantry Division artillery battalion, and we were assigned to it. And that's we stayed right up there on Custer Hill.
The Gulf of Tonkin incidents must have occurred either at the very near the very end of your training or very closely thereafter. Do you remember that? And what?
No, I don't. To us, Vietnam was insignificant. I can remember going down to the main post with a bunch of guys several times, and they'd show these horrible Army training films. And they talk about the guerrillas in Vietnam blowing this up, and somebody would make a guerrilla sound, and we'd laugh, and it was ironic sitting in a foxhole later with fire with shells going all around you, was, you know, as a wake up call, because we just didn't take it seriously at first.
Okay. When did you first start taking it seriously? When did you learn that, in fact, you very well may go or were actually going to go to Vietnam, and there
summer
was a shooting war going on?
Summer of 65, there were rumors that the 1st Infantry Division was going. In fact, we started, I was in the 437th Army Band. I had auditioned in the winter, I think it was, in 64 and got transferred, and they had already told us that we were going to be playing departure ceremonies as the 1st Division left. And then as time went on, they started bringing other personnel that somebody may have been working in a whole different unit, unit like I was. And if they needed you, they'd pick you up, put you in the 1st Infantry Division, and that got serious. Yeah.
Okay. And what did you do in the interim from finishing your training in 64 to learning that the 1st Division was going to Vietnam in 65? What were you doing during that
period? I was with the communications squad there with the artillery unit, and we had a lot of time to kill. We spent a lot of time at the motor pool doing nothing, some in classes, weekends, a few weekends out in the field. To me, it was boring. There didn't seem to be any direction to it. I guess there was, looking back, but didn't seem to me to be much of a purpose. And I stayed there till in the fall at some point, and I can't remember when it was, probably October, I saw a sign down next door to the PX, and it said 437th Army Band. And then I began to regret that I never told the Army that I could play an instrument. And I went over and talked to one of the trumpet players, and he says, "Shh, you're nuts if you don't come here and try out." So I requested, and that's one thing I'll say about the Army. If you needed something like that, if you said, "I want to go do it," they would honor it. They're almost schizophrenic as far as I was concerned. They could treat you like dirt in 1 minute, but then if you ask for something, you know, "I want to see an IG," which I never did, but they I guess by law they had to respect that. So I tried out, and I transferred there to 437th Army Band there early winter, like October, November, and stayed there until, when did we leave? October, I think, for the 1st of October for Vietnam. I was not supposed to go and the gentleman whose name I gave you in Oregon for possible interview, mm-hmm. he was not supposed to go, but the Army in their infinite intelligence couldn't move at the time they had set, and they have these things set up to where everybody's discharge date is different, so that you have a flow to it. Not everybody leaves at once. Mm-hmm. And these guys were right at the tail end, a trumpet player and a trombone player, and they delayed it just a matter of a week or two, and it meant that they were ineligible, and they pulled me and Kelly in, and we left, like I say, the 1st of October for Nam. Okay. It was a fluke.
Now, how did you, what was your mode of transportation to Vietnam?
It was cool. We took a train out. I'd never been west of West Texas, and we took a train to Oakland, mm-hmm. and we got on a ship, and since we were the band and we had to have places to put our instruments, instead of going down with the bunks that are 6 inches high or whatever they are, we had dependent cabins. We had two to a cabin. So it was a pretty cushy for a soldier.
Mm-hmm. And how long did it take you to get to Vietnam?
It took over 3 weeks, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it took 3 weeks. It was the better part of a month.
Do you remember when you first arrived in Vietnam?
Yes.
What was the most striking thing about it?
They were not prepared. Even the sergeants, the squad leaders there at the band, they were telling us it was a hot place. I mean, it was dangerous, and there's no telling what we'd find. We were actually at a recreation area. Mm-hmm. Vung Tau, I believe it was called.
Okay.
there was nothing to it, but we were scared to death. And we rode in. We spent the night, and you could see the tracers going off in the jungle, so we knew we weren't in the United States anymore. But then again, it wasn't all that bad. And we got on one of those landing boats, I can't even remember what you call them, but mm-hmm. went on in first, and then we would play marches as the other people landed, and I got to see General Westmoreland that day.
Okay. Where was he?
He was there at Vung Tau.
He was in Vung Tau?
Yeah, to get... I imagine he was there because I feel like we were with some of the higher officers, because when we got to Nam, we were attached to headquarters. We were like within 100 yards of there where we lived. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's why he was there, because some big wigs were coming in with us.
Okay. And what about the Vietnamese people? When did you first see them, and what were your first impressions of the Vietnamese people?
A little cautious at first, because you know, we've been told you can't tell a Viet Cong from a South Vietnamese, and we were pretty, I think everybody, I know I was, I give anybody a chance. I was friendly with them, mm-hmm. as a language barrier would allow, and definitely I don't ever remember having any trouble with any conflict with them.
So where did you go from Vung Tau? How long did you spend there?
We stayed 2 weeks, and as the ships came in.
Okay.
And then they flew us to where we were stationed. I can't even remember the name. There was not much of a village. Mm-hmm. It was halfway. It was 1st Infantry Division headquarters between Saigon and Benoit Air
okay.
Base.
Mm-hmm.
And we landed there and began to work. That was the hardest work I have ever done in my life, or hopefully ever will. Setting up tents, digging trenches. The next day they didn't like where they were, so we'd tear them down and move them again. From from the time we got up, we'd work, go eat breakfast, work all day. We weren't really used to the heat. Mm-hmm. And then a number of times we'd work after supper meal, mm-hmm. the evening meal.
And for the 2 weeks you were in Vung Tau waiting for the other ships to come in, did the band play welcoming
yes.
music for
yes.
the arriving soldiers?
Yep.
Or,
okay. Yep, we'd go down to the beach, and they'd set us up, and usually I guess we would play. The way I remember it was when the commanding officers would come in and shake hands with whoever was greeting them, and we'd play marches. And
mm-hmm.
then there'd be time, idle time. They'd say, well, there's nothing happening for a couple of hours, and it was really a good introduction to Nam, because nothing like you've seen with people going immediately into conflict in World War II and World War One. I mean, my situation was we would just, like we were on R&R for 2 weeks.
Mm.
And got to go to, you could go anywhere. We didn't even carry a weapon. Go down to a cafe and drink a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And we were careful about what we ate. But
what kind of a briefing did you receive regarding that type of activity, and what restrictions were there?
Typical Army, don't have sex with any of the local girls, but if you do, get a condom.
Okay.
I always thought that was, that typified the Army, because they were so hypocritical, but just be good. They impressed on us as being good PR people, because we were banned, and that's what we were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we were given a pamphlet about Vietnam. I remember that very well. And it was pretty discouraging, because it told about how long they had been at war,
mm-hmm.
and the situation. And it didn't take Einstein to figure out that was a desperate situation over there.
And as PR people for the 1st Division, as the band, did you guys play for Vietnamese officials as well? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Not right away, but later we did.
Okay.
After that working I was telling you about,
mm-hmm.
It began to ease up in a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I left, there was the only work that was going on was some people that knew how to carpenter, and they were building things, but that stuff had let up for us a lot.
Okay.
And I was part of a brass quartet, and at Christmas, we accompanied a Vietnamese choir and got to play at the big headquarters in Saigon on Christmas Eve.
Mm-hmm.
I was impressed. When I tell other people about it, they go, oh, yeah, well, it's... But it was. I mean, there was more brass around there than you could shake a stick at.
Mm-hmm.
And security very tight, even though it was during the Christmas ceasefire,
mm-hmm.
and that was exciting.
Mm-hmm. Now, for the 2 weeks that you were in Vung Tau, were there any incidents, anybody getting in trouble or shot at? Or?
Nope.
Okay.
Nobody got into a fight. Nobody got intoxicated to where the point they were, you know, obnoxious.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember renting a bicycle, me and another guy, and we left the town, left the little village, and rounded a corner, and you couldn't see because of the hills, and we passed a guy in black pajamas riding a bicycle with an automatic strapped to his back,
mm-hmm.
and I nearly lost control of my bodily functions. It scared us both, because we didn't know. You know, we figured everybody that wore black pajamas was Viet Cong, and every Viet Cong wore black pajamas at that point. But he smiled and nodded and went on.
Okay. All right, so after you went to your main base camp,
mm-hmm.
and set everything up, you said all that hard work that you guys had to do.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of routine did you eventually fall into in terms of your daily activities?
Well, there was not any work before breakfast or after supper. There was a relaxation time both times. Still some work during the day, and we played some jobs locally.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I didn't like, I did not like some of the places we went, and those were the places we needed to go. If anybody was in need of a morale booster, mm-hmm. and let somebody know that they were trying to at least do something, of course, they'd rather had James Brown playing for them, but, mm-hmm. I mean, it sent a message. We were here to try to do something for you, mm-hmm. but, God, those couple of places we went were rough. Mm. You could feel the tension. Yeah. You didn't have to know what was going on. Yeah. They never took their steel pots off. They never put down their rifles unless it was to eat or sleep. And any time they left their tent, they had to carry them. And that's where we got into firefights. We had snipers at our base camp. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember any bullets flying over me except when we left.
Hmm. Do you remember where this incident occurred?
I'm going to say it was Ben Cat was the worst place I've ever seen in my life.
Okay.
I think Ben Cat, we were playing on the back of a truck, and we heard the pop, pop, pop of a firefight, and several of them grabbed their helmets, and they took off to the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like it's like we would have gone to mail call. You know, they got up and went out and took care of business, and then they came back, and then that night, being guests, we didn't have a covered foxhole.
Mm-hmm.
They put us in a tent that they were just adding on, and there was a foxhole, but it wasn't covered.
Mm-hmm.
And a big black guy came up the back, and we heard a pop, and a carbine has a real distinctive sound to it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the snipers used. And it went pop, and of course we all stiffened up and waited for to see what was going to happen. And that black guy came through and said, "Gentlemen, get yourselves together." And I beat him out the door. He was already moving. I got up and had my steel pot, my rifle, and my ammo. And we're in that stupid foxhole, but there was no top on it. So mm-hmm. shells were just flying everywhere. And they were trying to get us to quit. We didn't understand. We had a cushy place. What they did was, when they'd get a sniper, everybody would take a position, and they'd look up, and they'd quit firing. And they had a squad that would get out and walk till they saw him, and then pop him if he was close. But we kept shooting, and I think he was a major. The sucker had been through the Korean War. He got killed that night. He was in a headquarters barracks. The French left a lot of barracks-type buildings scattered around. And he walked out on the front porch to see what all the shooting was about. And, of course, the VC, they knew who to... They prized themselves on killing higher-ranking officers, and they popped him right in the chest.
Mm.
And the next morning, we played a memorial service for him. And... then got the heck out of there, thank God.
Now, how long would you typically stay at a place like Ben Cat?
Just a couple of days.
Okay.
Thank goodness.
And you would, provide a series of shows during the
mm-hmm.
day? Or
yeah, whoever they could get in at mm-hmm. different times. We'd play marches and a little bit of everything. We had some, what do you call them, Broadway type music,
mm-hmm.
popular things.
Okay. Who would control or decide what you played?
What was played was decided by, what did they call him? It was Don Fluell was his name. He was a warrant officer. I don't remember what grade. But band leaders were not real commanders. Mm-hmm. We had a captain that was over the clerks, the band,
mm-hmm.
I don't remember what all, but he had several different units, and he was the commanding officer. And the warrant officer would decide what we played and when. I don't know who decided where we went. I think it was somebody in headquarters said we need a band somewhere, and then we'd go.
So you weren't granted all that much flexibility, or you know, you couldn't. I mean, it's hard to play something by the Beatles.
Yep. Nope.
With your instruments, but you, well, know, you can improvise.
We could have done more than we did. It was, as an army band, it was pretty straight laced.
Oh, really?
Yes. We could have done better. Even in the high school band, I remember the band director letting down his hair and letting another trumpet player take a solo and rock around the clock. Mm. Sure, you don't. That's too old for you, but.
No, I know the music.
And even we did that in the stands, but there wasn't any of that in the Army. It was pretty rigid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's what that brass quartet was so neat. That's what made it so neat. We'd play what we wanted to, and they'd leave us alone because there we were doing something worthwhile, and it was like we didn't exist when we were out practicing.
Now, was Bill Haley and the Comets still popular?
They were kind of passe.
Yeah.
Beatles were gaining. James Brown. That Detroit Motown thing was popular.
Okay. Did you get a lot of requests for that type of music?
No. No. We would get occasional requests from Australians to play something Australian, and we just didn't. We weren't prepared.
What was the choice of the Australians? Waltzing Matilda?
Uh-huh.
Or
yep.
Was it?
Yes.
Okay.
And I regret to this day, we should have done it. They were making a terrific sacrifice, and they're some of the best people I have met over there. They're just great.
Yeah.
And Mr. Flewell said, no, we don't have it. Well, he should have gotten it,
That's funny. Well, describe the firefight. That or some of the other firefights that you were involved with when you went out.
Well, it was wild. You'd hear popping, and somebody'd say hit the trench or something. And I remember one night, I do not know where we were. It wasn't a particularly bad place. It was close to a town, but somebody came in to harass us, and there was a lot of firing going on. And there was a thing called a Claymore mine.
Mm-hmm.
And it was operated by hand, and you squeeze these two levers together, and it created an electrical current that would go out and set it off, and it was devastating. I never saw anybody hit with one, but it didn't take much imagination. And shooting, firing, everybody's shooting around, and they finally pull back. I don't think anybody ever got hit. And as we were dismantling it, this South Vietnamese troop started to pull the wire from that handle, and he squeezed a handle, and I held my breath because there were people out there, and I thought, he's killed them, but it didn't go off for some reason. Very lucky, but it was just like what seemed like 20 minutes. It probably wasn't five of shooting and not being able to see an enemy, not being able to see anything. They knew exactly what they were doing. They'd stir things up and leave.
Now, how would you typically travel to these locations? By truck, helicopter, or combination?
Truck, if it was close. We traveled in those two-rotor Chinook, I think they called them, helicopters. Traveled in one of those once. When we left Ben Cat, they put us in one of those, a C-123. That would just barely make the tree line, and we didn't care. When we were going up, we went by truck, and in Vietnam, convoys needed to move fast, really fast, and we bogged down. And VC had a bomb under a bridge and a mine and blew it up, and it just bowed the truck. It was about three-quarters of a mile to a mile ahead of us, and we passed it, and, of course, it was charred, and the truck frame was just bowed where it went off directly underneath. The choppers came in and took them out.
And when you traveled like that, you did carry weapons?
Yes.
Your M14? Or
yes.
By that time, you had M16s? Or?
No, I never got one. They were getting them. I left in the end of February, and the combat troops had them, but the support people like engineers and us were going to get them later.
End of February of 66?
Yes.
Okay. Now, were there ever any incidents where your fellow band members got injured or killed?
No. After I left, one got shot by a sniper in the hip. Mm-hmm. And while we were there, during all that setting up, mm-hmm. and relatively unsecure area, we got shot at, and nobody ever got hit.
How about mortared and or rocketed?
Nope.
Did they ever use heavier weapons on your base camp?
Yes. We sent mortars out mm-hmm. all night long, but we never got one in.
Mm.
And the rockets, they didn't have those mm-hmm. until later. It was like 67.
Okay. Well, are there any other events or incidents that you'd like to discuss concerning your Vietnam service?
No, well, it's just like I said in that questionnaire. To me, when I think back, you know, not being in combat, you don't have that trauma. Some scary situation being shot at, but the people, that probably bugged me the most, the way GIs treated the Vietnamese.
Can you provide some examples?
Talking down, calling them names. I don't remember ever being physical with them, you know, like hitting them, but maybe pushing them.
Mm-hmm. Are these fellow band members that conducted themselves
yeah,
this way?
Yeah, and just anybody, yeah. There just seemed to be this contempt for the South Vietnamese, except for females. They treated females a lot better.
Yeah.
And even the people that came to work on our post were treated fairly well. But just general, and we had to treat the people like we went to a place. It was, I can't remember what they call it, a pacification mm-hmm. ceremony. Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't pacified. The VC were through with it. They had every young man and woman. All that were left were old people and kids. Mm-hmm. And we went in and played music and ate with them and they had speeches and all that stuff. It was shoot.
When was that? Do you recall?
No. There are no seasons to tie to, and so I really can't remember. I remember driving forever on a truck through. It can be pretty threatening, you know, with snipers, because Vietnam has a lot of trees. It's like mm-hmm. the Philippines or any of the tropical islands. It's heavily wooded at places and beautiful, but spooky. And I remember we drove and drove and drove and drove out there, and then we got there, and to celebrate pacification. It's kind of a not-too-funny joke because there was nothing left.
Now, did you guys talk about those types of things?
Yeah, room? Yeah. And we were decent. I mean, we treated the people that we were with and things like that when we did PR work. The Vietnamese treated them well.
Yeah.
That was our job. I'm thinking more of in Saigon
mm-hmm.
and even in any town,
yeah.
A lot of the GIs, I thought, treated the Vietnamese pretty rotten.
Well, I mean, did you talk about how silly it was? You're in there doing this
yeah.
pacification celebration,
yes.
and it seemed
yeah.
you know that the VC had already gotten everything
yeah.
wanted out of that village. So
yeah,
before. So
yeah,
you,
that
you
was
did
pretty,
talk about that.
We talked about it, yeah,
okay.
And it was obvious and. It was just our job, though. I mean,
mm-hmm. yes. How was morale in the unit? In the band?
Pretty darn good. They were a lot more military. That 437th Army Band I was in was very relaxed, very informal,
mm-hmm.
and being attached to a real infantry division, they were more military,
mm-hmm.
But. Still, it was good.
Okay. How were you treated in the band by the combat units, the combat arms guys?
They didn't have just a lot of use for us. the hardcore combat troops, they were polite most of the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you were alluding a while ago to doing something, you know, they would play something they'd like to hear.
Yeah.
We should have done that. I hope now that they're doing more of that, but they were polite, but we didn't do a lot for them. But again, you send a message, and we knew that.
Yeah.
We were sweating as hard as they were. We traveled further to get to them, and we were working to try to entertain them. And mm-hmm. and there wasn't any frustration in that area as far as waste of time or anything.
And there wasn't any overt anger that, you know, or hostility. Here you guys are in this band back in the base camp there. We're safe.
No. I never picked up on any of it.
Okay.
I remember one time the engineers that were right next to us, now those guys worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one of them, they told us right at the last minute, we're going down and play something. I think they probably had a morale problem down there. We're going down there and play, and so we grumbled and we got our stuff together in the evening and went down there and heard one or two of them say, there's that effing band. What do we need them for?
Okay.
We ain't no more happy to be here than you are. But most of the time, like, if you go to... It's a different attitude. They acted like they were pleased to see us.
Mm.
I remember Bob Hope came at Christmas, mm-hmm. and everybody can't remember that. I thought I'd never forget that singer and dancer was with him. God, she was hot. Joey Heatherton. Oh, Lord, Mr. Maxer. She was something. And
how do you spell her first name?
Joey.
Oh, Joey
Heatherton. Yeah.
Okay.
Boy, she was married to Lance Rensel, who was a wide receiver for the Cowboys,
uh-huh.
back in the late 60s.
Yeah.
Pretty boy.
Mm-hmm.
She was gorgeous,
mm-hmm.
and sexy. And I remember, of course, all the guys at Hoop and Holler, and they introduced a male singer.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, this is going to be embarrassing. They're not even going to give him a round of applause. And they received him just as well. I mean,
mm-hmm.
we were happy to see anybody coming over there. And I think my point is, I think some of the guys, the combat troops, probably didn't like some of the stuff we played, but it was something different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, did you provide support for the USO shows, like Bob Hope's show that came over? Or
no.
Did they come with their own bands?
That was big stuff. No, we didn't that.
So you just went as spectators as well?
Yes.
Okay. How many of those shows did you see, USO shows?
Just that one. I was very lucky. It was a great show. There was something interesting. There were some Vietnamese people there.
Mm-hmm.
We played a church service, that brass quartet. Before that, it was on Sunday when they came.
Okay.
And we played a church service, and then we went to it, and there were two or three Vietnamese that said, do you think we could go see the show? And all of us, I guess, you know, really selfish. Well, all four of us at once, no. Only soldiers are allowed. We didn't know.
Yeah.
We just thought, how dare you? That Bob Hope is ours, baby. No.
Were there many Vietnamese at those shows?
No. They weren't particularly welcome.
Yeah.
And I don't remember seeing any. I'm sure there were some down front, but...
Yeah. Well, I would imagine that when you weren't out in the field doing those shows, you had a lot of downtime back at the base camp.
A lot.
What did you spend your time doing? Were there a lot of Army services there, the libraries and
no.
things like that?
No. There was nothing. We practiced.
Mm-hmm.
We sat around. We did odd jobs. There was always something to do,
yeah.
some little thing once the thing was built.
Mm-hmm.
And... we played retreats. We played little local jobs, and we'd run into Saigon and pick things up, supplies, and come back if that happened. You wanted to volunteer to do that,
mm-hmm.
and so it just I don't remember extended periods of time that we sat, because there was something usually going on, but after a while, that hard work of being of getting everything set up, mm-hmm. settled out.
Mm-hmm. Were there many problems in your unit, racial tensions or anything like that?
No. I remember being discriminated against. I'm Caucasian, and when I was in the 437th, the timing was awful. Mm. We had an IG inspection, thorough IG inspection, just before I left. And the IG looked us over and said, "You haven't had any Spec 4 promotions. We'll get you some." We were gone. So I missed it. I was still a PFC when I went to NOM, and mm-hmm. first ones to get them were the black truck drivers. And I resented that. I felt like there was some the warrant officer was playing them, mm-hmm. because they're loyal. They'd steal for him. I stole a Jeep in Saigon, and that kind of irritated me because I had it coming. I thought, but nothing overt. No.
Okay. And how much downtime did you get to spend in places like Saigon? Did you get to travel for R&R very much there?
Yeah, or? Yep. You could. I really don't remember. I remember I spent way too much money in Saigon. Buying stuff that you probably didn't need, Vietnamese junk. Mm-hmm. You're a lot better off to go to the PX and buying beer and talking to bar queens, mm-hmm. Vietnamese girls in the bar. Mm-hmm. And I remember I went more than I really needed to go.
Okay.
That wasn't a problem. We were so close.
How often would you go?
I'd say probably once every couple of weeks anyway.
Okay. And you just spend one day there, or like a
yeah.
Saturday?
Yeah. The only time we spent the night in Saigon was that time that we played for the Big Brass, mm-hmm. and they put us up there.
Okay. And what about alcohol and drug use in your unit in the band?
Oh, crap. There was more grass smoked over there. I never smoked a lick. I never tried it.
Mm-hmm.
But every night, I would drink 1, 2, 3 beers while we watched a movie or something going on in the evening. And I don't remember a lot of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that hit me, I'd never been around marijuana. Mm-hmm. And these guys were saying it was the best in the world. And it was in the tent, I mean, hanging low. The smoke. Every night.
Mm-hmm. There wasn't any testing for that, or
no.
How about the commanders and the senior NCOs? They didn't catch anybody and do anything about it.
No, they didn't care.
They didn't care.
Nah, it was you just didn't rub it in their face, and they didn't. They had to know it. I mean, good grief, you can smell it
mm-hmm.
a mile off, and. They just never, it never was a problem. There wasn't any heroin used that I know of.
Okay.
And I mean, I was in there were two trumpet players that were seasoned drug users. And I don't remember them ever using anything other than marijuana and maybe drinking a beer while they smoked.
Hmm. Okay. Well, when did you said you left in February of 66?
Yes.
And when you arrived back in the United States, what kind of reception did you receive?
Cool. Yeah.
Can you be more specific, a little more elaborate?
Well, let's see. The guy I gave you, his mm-hmm. name, Kelly, we left about the same time. I think he may have been a half a day behind me. And so... We hooked up. I think we may have been on the same plane. it was a huge thing, and they had nothing but seats. They took all, of course, first class out, and they just loaded with troops and take all 707. And I remember that we hooked up there in Oakland, and he asked me to spend the night. And I said, great. Well, we got out of there after all that bureaucratic bull, and I think we were waiting for his wife to come pick us up and went down to a bar. And I remember getting, you know, people getting looks. I think you feel how a Hispanic or a black feels, you know. You walk in some place, somebody cuts their eyes around at you. It was not very friendly at all. But most people were tolerant. I mean, I didn't, and Kelly didn't. We didn't go up and rub it in people's faces. You know, we've been to Nam, and whether you like it or not. So it was... it was tolerable, but the feelings were not too subtle.
And where did you go from there?
I took a train home. My father worked for the railroad, and he had told me about this train that ran through the Rockies. And I was so uptight. My sister was really disappointed. She wanted me to fly to get home sooner, and I'd flown from Saigon to I don't know where we landed, some Air Force base up there by Oakland. And I wanted some time, and I knew it took like 2.5-3 days to get home, and I went and bought a train ticket and went home and back to Wichita Falls. And that was neat. Time to wind down and talk to real English-speaking people.
Was there any difficulty for you readjusting to life in the United States?
No, not at all. In fact, that maturity, you know, that 2 years, and having that stupid draft obligation over with, I got better jobs until I finally did go to college, and that was better.
Now, how much longer did you have in the service when you got back? How much more obligation?
They called it 2 years of active reserve and 2 years of inactive reserve. And what happened was nothing happened the first year. No summer camp, no nothing. I thought, all right. But then the second year, after I'd been discharged, I got called to Fort Hood for 2 weeks. And that was it.
So when you got back from Vietnam, how much time did you actually spend on active duty after that?
That 2 weeks.
Just 2 weeks.
That's it. I don't know what happened. I guess they forgot us.
Wow. Okay. So, as things progressed in Vietnam, were you keeping track, watching? How the war was progressing and things like that.
Oh yeah, yeah. It. You know, you feel. Well, I don't know, compassion, you know, you see one side of it. You know, the troops are over there. And I could understand a little bit how they get demoralized and not have any pride and not care whether they won or not, really. I could see that, even though it was not like that when we were there. We just did our job and got out and came home. But I could see that. And I don't know that anybody, unless they were old enough to live through the Civil War, could ever see society divided like we were. I mean, it was, that to me was like watching something just unreal.
Now, when did you actually enter college?
Oh, 70.
So the war was still going on.
Yes.
Where did you go to school?
Midwestern State University in Wichita Falls.
Was there a significant anti-war movement there?
No. No.
Was there any anti-war movement at all? Or?
I don't remember any, because I was not. See, I was already 26, something like that, 27. So, I was in a different crowd, and there was nothing overt, nothing. Noticeable as far as anti-war, a lot of talk, of people against the war, but I don't remember anybody being really belligerent.
There weren't any teach-ins or there weren't any draft card burning sessions or rallies or anything like that?
No. But Midwestern state, you know, in Wichita Falls, pretty calm, pretty much. I don't remember.
I take it it's a politically conservative area that supported the war?
Yes, pretty much. And military. We got Shepherd Air Base there, so,
Okay. What did you think of the anti-war movement and other universities and throughout the United States?
Well, you can't, it's still, I haven't gotten over that to this day. When people are disruptive, I think it, in society, I think it bothers you a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I could see the futility and question the motives of why we were even there. And the thing that it got me the most was, let's don't make it any worse for the people that are over there. That it was compassion for them, the only reason I had anything against anti-war people. You know, when we went out on a train, we were pulling into Oakland, the sergeant, one of them came back and said, no, he was one that was there. He was in charge of getting us where we were supposed to go. He said, you know, we've had some anti-war demonstrators. Some of them have even gotten on the train. And, you know, if that was to happen, if they got hurt getting off, nobody'd say anything, you know what I mean. And after he left, we all looked at each other and said, bullshit. I'm not gonna mess with those people. You know, there wasn't any great support for them, but we're not going to beat them up. I mean, shoot. That was my problem. The war took away from the people that were there and made it, I think, more dangerous for them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I could see their point, too.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the events as they unfolded later in the war, especially, you know, the 68 Tet Offensive, Johnson's decision not to run for re-election, Nixon's Vietnamization program?
It just added to the whole thing. It was futile. It, you know, I hate to use the word stupid, but it was.
Mm-hmm.
Extending our commitment that much for something like that, there was no support, and they must have known that. McNamara, the Secretary of Defense,
mm-hmm.
lied out his teeth saying that there was support for it and that we were winning. We were killing more people than they were, but there wasn't any support, and he had to know that. I mean, and as it began to unravel, it was just even more depressing that all those people died and we spent all those resources on a corrupt, weak government that was just out for themselves, you know. Certainly wasn't any fan of the communists, but they had a purpose. They had a goal.
Mm-hmm.
And Vietnamese were rotten to the core, mm-hmm. their government was.
And what would you be most critical of regarding the American policy and strategy in Vietnam?
Okay, now give me an example. What?
You know, the as far as how we were fighting the war, some of the political posturing for the peace talks. You know, what did you think was most detrimental to us winning in Vietnam?
It was a no-win war. We should have known that. There is no way you can go in to a civil war. They had the support. The Viet Cong had the support of the people. Our government knew it, and I don't, you know, their hands were tied somewhat because they were limited. They couldn't bomb, and then they did bomb limited in a limited way and this and that, and they kept screaming, our hands are tied or we could win this war, and I don't believe that. They wouldn't want it, whatever happened, unless they annihilated the whole country like we did Japan. Tear out, you know, the infrastructure and then go in and rebuild it.
Mm-hmm.
But we could not have won that they didn't get to the peace table fast enough, as far as I'm concerned. If it got too far, if it had gone too far for us to get out, even when I was there, I mean, they were sending troops over. That was a big mistake when we went over in 66 and 67. And once it went past that, they should have said, let's go to the table and try to get out of this with some semblance of dignity. But it was a lost cause. They should have known it. I think they did know it.
What major lessons do you think we should take away from this?
That very thing, you know, it scares me whenever we start saying we're going to go help somebody. Because I'm burned so bad with Vietnam, and I'm afraid young people don't know it, won't remember it. And that is a terrible, terrible thing to do, to go in and try to rearrange the world. You can't do it. If the people, well, I think they do pretty much now know, but if the people had known back then what we saw in Vietnam, South Vietnamese Army totally demoralized, inept, cowardly, I hate to use that word, but it's true. They didn't care. And I think we'd seen that. It would have been over. But McNamara and Johnson kept telling us, oh, it's going to be all right. And it wasn't.
Mm-hmm. What did you personally, as a just as a person, what did you take away from your Vietnam experience or Vietnam service?
Well, like I said in that questionnaire, cynicism, I think. I'm a lot more cynical now of government. I'm patriotic, and, you know, if they wanted me to serve again, I'd go. But I'm very questioning if somebody says something is like this in Bosnia, a situation occurs in Syria. I really don't believe them until I hear more, because I know they'll lie to you in a heartbeat.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
No. I hope one thing, if you get this together, is there going to be a finishing point for you?
You want to stop the interview now, or?
No.
Oh, okay.
What I'm wondering about is, we're not going to get to go to New Mexico this year. That's why I'd have loved to have gone out and talked to you in person, but we can't for various reasons.
Yeah.
But we do love to go, and I thought when you get this finished, I'd love to see some of the finished product anyway.
Right. Well, what I'll do with the oral history that we've just conducted is we'll transcribe it. I'll listen to the tape and go over the transcript and then send you a copy.
Oh, okay.
And so you can review it. And then after that, basically it'll be made available to anybody who's interested in looking at it.
Okay.
They'll be able to listen to the recording or read the transcript, whatever they prefer. And it'll become part of our larger collection of archival materials related to personal experiences and the general experience of in Vietnam.
I'd love to see
some other
guys' experiences.
I don't know if you have a computer, but we have a website. You can look through a lot of the stuff that we have currently.
Yeah.
On the web, as far as just looking at the types of collections we have.
Okay.
And eventually, a lot of the oral histories will be on the web as well. So.
All right.
So anything else you want to talk about?
Can't think of anything.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Parks. This ends the interview with Mr. Jim Parks.